Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Technology. I'm your host, Jasmine McNeely. Now, imagine a political party, actually a political movement, focused on areas related to communication and information policy, a movement primarily concerned with technocratic impositions into the ideals of free culture, privacy, government transparency, and other technology policy issues. What would such a movement look like? Well, we don't have to really use our imaginations much about this. Such parties and movements exist or are arising all over the world. And today we're going to talk specifically about one or more of those, and that is the Swedish Pirate Party. To help us with our discussion, we have Patrick Burkert, an associate professor in the Department of Communication at Texas A&M University. He's also a visiting scholar at the University of Helsinki, and he's the author of the new book, Pirate Politics, The New Information Policy Contest. Welcome, Patrick.
Thanks for having me, Jasmine.
No problem. I'm really interested in this. But first, just to give the audience a little background, could you tell us some more about yourself and how you got interested in pirate politics?
Well, my interest in pirate politics really started out as an interest in popular music and looking at how music fans were beginning to use new technology, particularly peer-to-peer file sharing, in sharing new music and music collections online. And in particular, the Napster system caught my attention back in the, early 2000s, late 1990s,
right.
Getting old. And it was the sequence of events that took down Napster as a legal option and subsequent iterations of peer-to-peer file sharing, which made me realize that, for one thing, technologies for sharing were becoming targeted for disruption or elimination by large media companies. And then I began to realize that the fan base who were using and developing and enjoying these systems were beginning to organize and fight back. And it was research done on music and cyber liberties that made me aware of the fact that coalitions were forming in North America, which were focused on protecting software as free as a variety of free speech, and protecting access to untrammeled internet resources in general as a matter of freedom of access to the internet. And as we began to learn about some of the online systems being developed to surveil and track and collect user information online, both to fight piracy but also for marketing purposes, I began noticing that a lot of these coalitions were focusing on privacy concerns as well, online privacy. So when I was finishing a book called Music and Cyber Liberties in 2010, I began to get messages about a pirate party organizing in Sweden around the same period of time. And so I realized that really there was an international phenomenon to look at. And at that juncture, I started on the next book, and that's taken me to Sweden and to Germany and to Finland. And at this juncture, there are pirate parties in dozens and dozens of countries around the world now.
So what exactly is pirate politics?
Pirate politics is a social movement that started in civil society organizations to engage politicians and voters around the issues of digital rights. And those rights, those areas of concern are privacy, free speech, and access. And, you know, the pirates adopted the name pirates because they figured it was a catchy way to draw attention to cyber liberties issues. In fact, one of the leaders of the Pirate Party of Sweden, Rickard Falkving, said, if we called ourselves the copyright the Copyright Reform Party, nobody would pay attention to us whatsoever.
Right.
So they've embraced this pirate label.
So what made your book focuses a lot on SPP, or the Swedish Pirate Party, what made Sweden a hotbed or a place where such a party was ripe to arise? And Sweden, I would also note, is like has ties to WikiLeaks, correct?
Yes, they do.
Yeah.
That's a great question, and I spend some time in pirate politics investigating why Sweden in particular fomented this movement and allowed it a geographical territory to take off from. And I look at a lot of factors, but you know, I think the most important one is the fact that the Pirate Bay search engine developed in Sweden among music fans who were busy trying to develop technologies for webcasting music, and as their index of searchable files for download developed into the Pirate Bay, it attracted a lot of attention from American-based, U.S.-based media companies who insisted that Swedish authorities take it down. And in 2006, we saw the first example of police actions that actually targeted the Pirate Bay as a file sharing search engine, and disrupted the Pirate Bay as a server farm on Swedish territory. So the backlash among fans and techies and geeks and developers who were all dependent in one way or another on the Pirate Bay began gathering their energies around these in opposition to these police raids. There was another legal event as well in 2009, which galvanized an incipient party into a formal party, and that was the passage of a military surveillance bill, which put the military in charge of monitoring internet communication across Swedish borders. And pirates very quickly connected the dots between, you know, the need for surveillance of, you know, supposedly terrorist activities and child pornography, and the need for corporations to begin monitoring the internet for evidence of file sharing. And so piracy and privacy became united in some important ways in the minds of internet activists in Sweden. I also look at how Sweden has allied itself politically with the United States and Japan and Canada and the European Commission, all of whom negotiate free trade agreements around media exports. And since Sweden is one of the few countries in the European Union that actually has more export media exports than imports, the Swedish government was very eager to tamp out piracy as a cultural phenomenon in the country, and work very closely with the United States in developing some strategies for doing so. And there are some political factors around the Swedish participation in the European parliamentary elections that factor into, you know, the way that the pirates were able to get a foothold into the European Parliament. Low voter turnout in European elections typically offers opportunities for smaller parties in parliamentary systems to engage the formal political system. And I think we saw evidence of that as well in 2009 when the pirates eventually placed two members of parliament at the European Parliament. And then I look at cultural factors as well. Sweden has a huge techno culture, you might say. There's a lot of hackers and web developers and software developers and musicians who are technophilic and who enjoy really good internet connectivity around the country. And, you know, these people depend on unfettered internet resources for their creative lives and often for their livelihoods. And I think the technophiles in Sweden really banded together in support of pirate politics. And one of the last considerations on the cultural side of things that I look at as well in the book Pirate Politics is this long-standing tradition from the Middle Ages, actually, of public access, respect for public access to private property. Mm-hmm. And partly because, you know, Sweden and other Nordic countries have such cold, dark winters. As a matter of survival, Scandinavian communities permitted individuals and families to cross private property from going from one village to another without impediment. And this notion of every man's right or allemansrätten has been a long-standing tradition, allowing individuals the right to access private property, and even canoe and ski across private territories and collect berries and collect mushrooms, without the fear of being shot or arrested. I'm comparing my own home state of Texas, I guess, mentally to the Swedish situation. But allemansrätten, I think, is a deeply instilled and ingrained cultural value for not only Swedes, but Scandinavian societies in general. And even in the UK, you can find the rambling tradition protected. And I think of the younger generation of people here who've grown up with the internet as more or less adopting this cultural sensitivity to public access, geographically speaking, and applying it to online territories.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because it seems that at least the pirate parties, in comparison to other, I guess, technology-oriented or movements that have used technology in the past couple of years, that the pirate politics and parties, mm-hmm, have maintained a certain level of activity and engagement, whereas other activism or movements using technology have kind of faded away. And I'm wondering if you have any idea why, what has made the Pirate Party and those movements connected to it so enduring, I guess?
That's a great question. And I'll start by saying that the endurance of pirate politics is actually being called into question right now because the Swedish Pirate Party didn't do so well in the last European parliamentary elections, although the German Pirate Party picked up a seat for the first time in the European Parliament on this last go-around. But I think that you're right. There is an enduring and persistent trail of activities and evidence of organization in the pirate parties. Just this year, the pirate parties of Europe formalized a pan-European platform so that activists who want to run campaigns in the future have a common platform to organize around. Are you still with me?
Oh yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, all right. and so that's evidence of a continued gelling of the movement, I would say. But I think the more general answer to your question about the persistence of pirate politics is that we keep having new revelations practically every month about the endangered condition of internet freedoms, ranging from censorship online to reduced access and threats to net neutrality, for example, which is a really important cornerstone of the access principle of pirate politics. And I would say even more glaringly, privacy issues have really become prominent, I would say, in the public imagination, because we learn every day how, for example, the NSA and other government surveillance apparatuses are training their sensors on private communications practically without restriction. And even though the EU has some formal privacy protections in place, we're beginning to learn that there are some huge loopholes through which the United States government and potentially other governments as well can slip through and monitor private, commercial and non-commercial communication. And I think that growing realization that the internet is becoming an instrument of domination rather than a domain of freedom, as it has been, I think, in years past, is informing pirate politics in new ways every day and every year. So I think it's an unlikely movement. I think the movement's unlikely to diminish. Now, you raise the possibility that it may not be pirate parties who are the ones that defend the internet from these different forms of colonization, as I call it. And in fact, we're starting to see, at least in the European context, the European Greens are re-energizing partially around an idea of cultural environmentalism based on internet freedoms. And they're starting to identify the internet as a natural domain with freedoms, emanating from it that are under attack and that are being polluted and that are being hemmed in by different kinds of powerful interests. And so different political parties are beginning to adopt policy platforms of the pirates. And so we may see that the pirate parties themselves have a diminishing presence, but their set of interests and their set of cultural orientations are picked up by other players.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I think of New Zealand and the rise now of the internet party with connections to, Kim.com.
Yes.
Do you think we'll see a lot more of these kind of parties arise as time goes on? Or...
I do. And now I think we have to be realistic about the fact that there are some political systems that are more amenable to cultural environmentalist parties of all stripes than others. And the parliamentary systems seem to be the ones, where these smaller parties, including the pirates, but also including the Greens, who started off as fringe parties, and there's new feminist parties arising in Europe right now. But the parliamentary systems seem to allow the smaller contenders to have greater traction and float some trial balloons, whereas our bicameral system in the United States, on the other hand, is punishing for third parties and smaller parties, and leads more often to gridlock than it does accommodation of new perspectives.
You know, in your book, when you're talking about the rise of pirate politics and parties, you use two dominant theoretical perspectives, and I just wanted to see if we could talk about those for a second. The first uses second generation critical theory, and then you also use new social movement theory to analyze the parties' rise in the histories and what they're doing now. And I was just wondering if you could perhaps talk about those two theories or theoretical perspectives, just to give the audience some background on those theories.
Sure. Well, second generation critical theory is adapted from the Frankfurt School of critical theory that was famously launched by Horkheimer and Adorno back in the Second World War period. And second generation critical theory is basically the set of Marxist approaches that their students elaborated from on cultural topics and political topics from the Frankfurt School. And there's one in particular that I look at, which is Habermas and his use of critical systems theory. And it blends together, I would say, the hermeneutic of suspicion that his instructors trained him in, but it also incorporates sociological systems theory of a more Anglo model. And what Habermas is able to do with critical systems theory is to describe how there is a realm of communicative rationality around which our societies can function, where we basically give each other space to reach mutual understandings and coordinate social action through dialogue and through debate. This has famously been parlayed into the public sphere theory that so many of our colleagues work with in social sciences. But I would say that, maybe the underutilized concept, which actually lies beneath public sphere theory in many ways, is this notion of the colonization of the life world, which is you might call it a meta-narrative for modern times, which describes how, communicative rationality or the life world, where we do have space to reach these mutual understandings in free and rational contexts, these spaces are being taken over by processes of bureaucracy and juridification, or the spread of rules and regulations over private domains of life and other areas that previously were freely negotiated, as well as market pressures, the classic neoliberal creep that we see into all aspects of contemporary life these days. And this idea of colonization of the life world works really well, I think, to describe some of the processes going on over internet sociality that the pirates are highlighting, right? I mean, they are showing how some of the key areas of communicative rationality, privacy, the expectation of privacy, the expectation of access to each other's ideas, and freedom of expression, these are all being burdened with rules and regulations and special conditions being imposed by, technocrats or police or bureaucrats of all kinds. And I think that the pirates are able to flag those processes and show them to be disruptive and damaging. And new social movement theory keys off of this basic model of colonization of the life world. And the same generation of scholars who graduated from, who took instruction from the Frankfurt School, also contributed to social theory that helped explain the emergence of feminism and in the 70s and 80s as a political movement in Europe, of ecology and environmentalism, of anti-nuclear weapons movements, anti-nuclear energy movements. And there's a school of thinking that that was principally looking at social movements from the 70s and 80s who describe cultural colonization in the second generation critical theory terms. And I've just borrowed that framework to see how well it works for pirate politics. And it was an experiment, but I think that we can find parallels today in the social movements from 30 or 40 years ago. And in fact, you know, I think that pirate politics might just be an extension of environmentalism and feminism perhaps the same social movement, just stretched intergenerationally.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting as you say that, and I wanted to ask you about terminology. And one of the terms you use just now and also in the book is the term colonization, which to me and perhaps to other people is a loaded term, right? So colonization, mm-hmm. we think of imperialism and just taking over of areas where people are already have formed communities and societies, and relating that to the pirate polity, politics, mm-hmm. and party, I'm wondering, like, are we seeing that people and the pirate polity, party, mm-hmm. and politics, that people are reacting against this, I guess, supposed colonization by government and state, and I would say, corporate actors, mm-hmm. with respect to their online communities and societies?
Yes. And just to get a little bit more specificity on this concept of colonization, the way it's used philosophically, or I would say linguistically, by Habermas, is to describe how the process of reaching an agreement or a mutual understanding with each other through language and through conversation, when these processes get replaced by non-linguistic processes or exchanges of money or exercises of power which bypass negotiations or bypass discussion, right? Bypass the use of language in solving problems and coordinating social action. That's evidence of cultural colonization. Mm-hmm. And what he's able to do is show how, there are, entire fields of social action and cultural communication that are carved out by the system for replacement, right? And, we can identify colonization in all kinds of institutions, education, medicine, among others, art, music. We can go down the list. And the fact that the internet is really a life world of its own, which supports every institutional framework for intersubjective communication, really does, help us. I think it really helps support the case for colonization, because it really is like a cultural environment that supports all of our institutions. But to your point about colonization being a term borrowed from previous traditions, yes, I think colonialism as an economic model of early modern period, and discussions and discourses of post-colonialism would be really helpful in in the discussion of pirate politics. And in fact, that's a conversation that we've just begun to have in the academic community, where, for example, pirate modernities are being debated. You know, how there are pirate alternative visions of modernity being articulated in the developing world, especially, which are more dependent on pirate economies and pirate cultures for their survival and for their flourishing. So, I think, you know, the post-colonial discussion is one that would be fruitful, and I look forward to engaging it. Didn't really get to it in this book, but I can definitely see the intersections.
Mm-hmm. Now, a question that arises is, and not just with the SPP and pirate parties all over the world and other emerging movements, is what is it about the technology? Or is there something about the technology that promotes or sparks or is a catalyst for movements or assists in raising engagement and activism? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What is it? What is it about the technology?
Well, I mean, I think we can look at media sociology and media technologies for instruction here, and it's really the ability of the internet as a communication platform to permit many-to-many communication, as well as peer-to-peer communication in distributed networks and ad hoc networks and informal networks. And there's been so much research done, you know, comparing mass media technologies to new media technologies, for example, that we can turn to for instruction here. And in general, it's just, you know, the freedom and the flexibility that the internet provides for mobilization of resources in terms of ideas and in terms of messaging, as well as capital and news and information and gossip, you know. All of these forms of media are rapidly deployable and spreadable through the internet. And I think in a way, you know, what pirate politics does is remind us of the fact that this ability, the abilities to communicate these ways are part of the stakes of the game, mm-hmm. you know, and if we give up some of the freedoms that the internet provides us to pursue these functionalities, you know, we also give up some important political freedoms and political possibilities as well. You know, I'm just thinking back to, you know, the World Trade Organization protests in Seattle and Geneva, and some of the anti-globalization movements, the Occupy movement, the movement of the squares across North Africa and the Middle East in the last 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, and a lot of these distributed conflicts really wouldn't have been as visible or as effective as forms of political messaging without the internet there as a dissemination platform. Now, I want to be careful, and I want to qualify that by saying that, you know, access to the internet does not a social movement make,
right,
by any means. And Evgeny Morozov is an author who reminds us time and time again that the internet, you know, the use of the internet among radicals and among anti-establishmentarians can be used as a tool for co-opting movements as well as for enabling them.
Mm-hmm. So, Pirate Politics, the new information contest, where do you see in the, I guess, perhaps in the next year, 2 to 5 years, where do you see Pirate Politics going or moving?
I just finished this book, Jasmine, and you're asking me about the next one already. Well, I have to say, I don't think we've seen the end of Pirate Politics. I think we're going to see it morph. You know, what's happened in Sweden is kind of sad. The Pirate Bay Four, who were put on trial a few years ago and convicted of copyright crimes, are being punished now through fines and imprisonment. We've seen we haven't talked about WikiLeaks, but you know, certainly the principles of WikiLeaks and other organizations oriented towards internet freedoms are under attack and subject to activists of all stripes, but especially around internet freedoms, are under a great deal of scrutiny. So I think it's a dangerous juncture, but at the same time, I also think that there are enough young people who feel that their opportunities for social mobility depend on an untrammeled internet. I think young people in particular are going to continually fuel the movement. If you look at Pirate Politics from, another perspective, which is as a political opportunity structure, all of these threats to the internet provide the perfect basis for ongoing backlash. And so I think as the Snowden files keep piling up, for example, we will reach a juncture where there's more populist backlash against internet colonization. And it may very well be that focus is turned on the United States and the United States surveillance systems, and maybe less attention is being directed inwardly within the European Union. So there may be this growing rift between the United States and our trading and cultural allies across the Atlantic that generates a dynamic. But the pressure is going to have to come from the grassroots, because at this point we don't see corporate leadership, and we certainly don't see leadership in the European Union right now that's focusing attention on pirate politics. So it's going to have to be a continuation of bottom-up mobilizations.
Mm-hmm. Now, the book, Pirate Politics, is from MIT Press, right? And the audience can find it, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and MIT Press, obviously, is bookstore, right?
Yes, and I found it on the Pirate Bay a couple of weeks ago.
That is awesome.
I probably shouldn't say that too loudly, or else my publicist is going to get angry with me.
And where can they find other writings from you?
Well, Music and Cyber Liberties is with Wesleyan University Press. And I also have a book out that's available in all the places you just mentioned, written with Tom McCourt, called Digital Music Wars, Ownership and Control of the Celestial Jukebox. Mm-hmm. And that's a few years old now, but it does provide an interesting technology and policy history that I think leads up to pirate politics quite nicely.
Great. Now, you're in Helsinki right now, and are you doing more research on pirate politics?
Yes, I'm working with this great team here who at the University of Helsinki, who's looking at how the pirate politics message has contributed to some of the European parliamentary election outcomes and campaigns. And looking for exactly these connections that you've been asking about so far, you know, where the influence has spread and where it's likely to lead. And so we're in many ways trying to make sense of how the movement is growing and evolving within and beyond the Swedish and German contexts.
Sounds good, and we look forward to hearing more about that. So, Patrick, thank you for coming on the show. This has
been
New Books in Technology. Goodbye, ladies and gentlemen.